tube to drool into. Armed with the latest technology, they'll scan your spit for hundreds of known polymorphisms, subtle mutations that may or may not kill you or make you smart. It was the horrible disease part that irked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Stick to personal ancestry, the FDA told 23andMe late last year.
I decided to get testing because I was teaching this new genetics course, and I thought, oh, perfect, I should get this done. And they were having a sale, too.
Rosie Redfield ordered her spit test before the barn door closed.
Why don't I pull up 23andMe?
Sitting in her office at the University of British Columbia, Rosie Redfield pulls up her genetic rap sheet.
Okay, so elevated risk, lupus, celiac disease, bladder cancer. I've got a relatively high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease.
Is there any Alzheimer's in your family, to your knowledge?
No, my family's great. No, there's no Alzheimer's in my family at all.
And so yet they say you've got a 12.5% risk.
Well, 12.5% risk isn't that high. And maybe there's just a lot of other genes in there that counterbalance the particular genes that have been identified.
It's easy for Rosie Redfield to shrug off bad genetic news. She teaches the stuff. For those who don't know a genotype from a pair of blue jeans, news like this can ruin an entire day. Dr. Roberto Mendoza is a clinical geneticist at the University of Toronto.
Most of the tests that are offered right now are based on association studies, but that's not causative. It's not telling you that it is going to happen, and I think that the public has a difficult time in interpreting a risk factor like that.
The bottom line for Mendoza, talk to your physician.
I don't think that sending a sample by mail and receiving a report without discussion with any healthcare professional provides that type of information.
Now, good genetic news is another story.
The certificate they sent me is quite impressive and has several signatures on it and a very official-looking stamp.
Jim Rupert is an associate professor in the School of Kinesiology at the University of British Columbia. A fancy certificate hangs on his wall.
DNA analysis performed on Jim Rupert has demonstrated a genetic advantage for endurance activity at the actinin 3 locus.
Rupert is the proud owner of an endurance gene, but he isn't headed for the Olympics.
I mean, one of the things I tell my students is that I could test them. It probably wouldn't mean much. But if I went out and tested 50,000 children in Canada, I would probably enrich my camp. That's not what people think when you talk about genetic testing. They assume, well, I can test your kid, and then I can tell you what your kid should be doing.
The most credible information from a direct-to-consumer genetic test may be the sort Daryl Cole purchased from the National Geographic's Genographic Project.
30,000 years ago, it looks like my dad's line is starting to get close to my mom's line in terms of meeting up, which, you know, as I'm saying that, is kind of blowing my mind.
Cole has learned something about himself, and he won't have to consult with his doctor.
What's beautiful about this, I find, it's just so personally intimate because it's telling me about my DNA makeup.
Judging from the popularity of personal ancestry products, most people would rather get in touch with their inner Neanderthal than go scrounging for genetic skeletons in the closet.
There's much to explore yet, to be determined.
An update on this story, 23andMe received that warning from the U.S. FDA back in 2013. In 2017, the FDA authorized it to market late-onset Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and hereditary thrombophilia risk reports. As for National Geographic's Geno kits, the Society ceased sale of these in 2019. National Geographic says at its website that it deleted or destroyed DNA data in June 2020, with the exception of info from users who'd consented to their use for population-related research. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor, a listener-supported podcast. I'm David Kattenberg. Their precise scientific name is a mouthful, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, but you don't want to get them in your mouth. Hard to avoid. Forever chemicals are in nonstick cookware, greasy food wrap, microwave popcorn bags, lipstick. They don't break down, they build up in your body, and they're very bad for your health. And most people have them in their blood. A recent mapping study reports that PFASs are present at high concentrations in thousands of spots across the UK and Europe. Now, a scientific study from the US reports 9 compounds in the blood of pregnant women and umbilical cords feeding their developing fetuses. Jessica Trowbridge is the study's lead author. We reached Jessica Trowbridge in San Francisco. You've just completed published a study on the presence of a family of chemical compounds, the PFASs and the PFOSs, in maternal pregnant women's bloodstreams and in umbilical cord blood. I'd like you to tell me about this. But in your article, you say that a prenatal exposure to a variety of chemical compounds that are considered dangerous in the United States is ubiquitous, and that less than 1% of over 40,000 chemical compounds known to be circulating have been actually or are being biomonitored. Can you talk about this? This is scary.
Yeah, it's a lot. We know that people in the U.S. are exposed to multiple different toxic chemicals from their environment, from their consumer products, and what we just don't know very much about them. And there's overall maternal mortality in the U.S. is among the worst in the developed world. Pregnancy-related complications are increasing, and it's not clear why. And so the next step is really to look at our environmental exposures, because we're really exposed to a toxic soup of chemicals in our environment. You mentioned that most of them are not biomonitored, and that is true. There, in the U.S., for example, we have a study called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. They regularly look for chemicals in our environment in people in a representative sample of the U.S. population. And they only monitor about 300 chemicals, maybe close to 400. And so if you think of the 40,000 chemicals that are on the market, many of which, tens of thousands of which are high production volume chemicals, these are chemicals that are produced in over 1 million pounds per year, we're really only scratching the surface with what we know about toxic chemicals in our environment. And so with our paper, we were really trying to identify chemicals that haven't been measured before or that we don't really know much about through our non-targeted process.
And when you talk about these chemicals being present in the environment, where are they?
Where are they not, maybe, is the question. We know that PFAS, for example, is in drinking water. It has been found in soil samples. It has even been found in places like the Arctic, which has no endogenous sources or no known sources of these chemicals. And then there's other chemicals in our food, our consumer products. It's really just our chemicals are everywhere.
And it's astonishing that these PFASs, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, I'm amazed that I can actually say it, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are found in cosmetics. They're found in lipstick.
Indeed, they are found in a lot of products. They're found in products like fabrics because they have stain and water resistant properties. And so when you buy a couch that's treated to be stain resistant, it likely contains PFAS chemicals. It's in our rain gear, in our waterproof shoes. They're also in firefighting foams. And so they're really in a lot of different products. And your paper takeout food containers also.
Before we launch into the details of your most recent study, Jessica Trowbridge, can you tell me what are the lifelong outcomes of exposure to PFASs and some of the chemical compounds that you've studied?
PFAS chemicals are associated with multiple different adverse health outcomes, like you said. They're associated in with immunologic effects, metabolic effects in the humans, with hormone disruption. And in pregnant women, it's associated with gestational diabetes and preeclampsia and those types of adverse health outcomes. And for the infant, it's been linked with birth weight, low birth weight, and adverse neurodevelopment. And things like low birth weight and adverse neurodevelopment in the fetus and the child can have long-term, lifelong consequences, including other complications like cardiovascular disease later in life. So we're focusing on a very narrow time frame, but we know that the exposures that occur during in utero and the impacts on birth outcomes can have lifelong consequences in the adult, in the child as they become adults.
And you mentioned gestational diabetes and preeclampsia. Can you tell me what these things are? People know what diabetes is, but people may not know what gestational diabetes is. And preeclampsia, what's that?
Gestational diabetes is very similar to diabetes that folks know about in adults, or type 1 and type 2 diabetes. In gestational diabetes, it's an imbalance of the insulin occurring during pregnancy. And this can lead to different complications for the mother and the child. It can lead to changes in birth weight. It's also related to preeclampsia. And preeclampsia is a condition during pregnancy that causes high blood pressure and that can actually be deadly for the mother if it's not treated on time and not caught on time.
Tell me about the results of your study, which was just published in the Environmental Health Perspectives Journal. And it was involved non-targeted discovery of chemical compounds. Tell me about that.
Well, what we did in this study was we measured 9 different chemicals in pregnant women. We measured the levels of chemicals in their bodies in both the maternal serum samples, maternal blood, as well as in the cord blood. And then we looked at the relationship of those chemicals with adverse health outcomes. Specifically, we looked at gestational diabetes and pregnancy hypertensive disorders. And this hypertensive disorder actually encompasses both preeclampsia as well as pregnancy-related hypertension. And we found that elevated levels of multiple of these compounds, specifically PFAS chemicals, as well as 2 abnormal fatty acids that are not normally found in people that are used in plastics production, actually, are associated with elevated levels of gestational diabetes. This paper is a continuation of previous studies and previous papers that have described what we call a non-targeted method or a high throughput method. And what this does is, we talked about earlier how we're exposed to hundreds of thousands of chemicals. We know very little about them. We don't even know what we're exposed to. And so trying to identify new chemicals in our environment is kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack. But let's say this haystack then has also bolts and nails and knives and any other metallic object you can think of. So we know there's exposures, but we don't know what they are. So non-targeted analysis is a process by which we can really limit and understand the broad breadth of chemicals that we're exposed to in the environment, given that we're exposed to hundreds of thousands of chemicals, and yet we really don't know what they are. So through this non-targeted method, we're running the blood through a high-resolution mass spectrometer. And that high-resolution mass spectrometer will give us a mass and a retention time. With the mass and retention time, you can assign it a tentative chemical structure. And so at this point, we call them features because we don't know what they are.
From maternal blood serum and from cord blood.
Correct. It's from maternal cord serum and the cord blood, and it includes both naturally occurring products like metabolites and different endogenous compounds, as well as exogenous compounds. And so it's a massive data set with hundreds of thousands of lines of data that we have to sort through to try to identify what we're interested in, which is toxic environmental chemicals.
Cutting to the chase, at the end of the day, you've spotted 9 chemical compounds that are PFASs and these fatty acids. What are they?
Well, at the end of the day, the previous studies found 55 novel chemicals that previously hadn't been measured in pregnant people. And then from that 55, we decided to confirm and quantify 9. To confirm and quantify a chemical, you actually have to go purchase the standard from a chemical laboratory, the maker of the chemical, and compare what we found with the one we purchased. So you actually know what you're comparing and confirm it. And so in my study, in this paper, we quantified 9 chemicals that we identified as being previously not measured in pregnant people, some of them, others that are of interest because they're related to adverse health outcomes, and to try to really understand a little more about what people are exposed to. Because we can say, we know people are exposed to multiple different chemicals. Our non-targeted analysis allows us to look beyond what we already know. So these chemicals that are measured by the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, for example, and really begin to look at other chemicals that we don't know anything about. And this is also important because in the US, our chemicals regulation doesn't really protect us from toxic chemicals very well. And often because we don't know what people are exposed to, I think PFAS is a good example. We've been exposed to PFAS for a really long time, and the evidence has continued to come out about its relationship with adverse health outcomes, and yet it's still not a chemical that's regulated in the US.
Now, there's 9 of these chemical compounds with tongue-twisting names: branched PFOS, linear PFOS, PFHXS, and then a variety of fatty acids, tridecanoic, octadecanadioic, deoxycoic, you know, 4-nitrophenol. That sounds pretty dangerous. Tetraethylene glycol. You calculated correlations between pairs of these. Which pairs of associated pairs of these 9 compounds were associated with gestational diabetes in the pregnant woman, or the hypertension? Can you talk about that? What associations did you find between one or several of these compounds and actual health conditions in mother and baby?
With the correlation, we were looking at the relationship between the chemicals themselves. And so we wanted to see, is linear PFAS related to branched PFAS? And is branched PFAS related to deoxycholic acid, for example? And we looked at them both within the mother in the cord blood and then between the maternal and the cord blood. So we wanted to see, are they related? Does, when the level of one chemical goes up, does the level of another chemical go up? And what we found was that the PFAS chemicals, the branched and linear PFAS, PFOS, and the PFHXS, those were all correlated. So as one of those chemicals goes up, the other do. And what that indicates to us is that there's potentially a common source of exposure. We also saw that chemicals were correlated between the maternal and the cord samples. And so as the level of a tridecanedioic acid goes up, so does the tridecanedioic acid go up in the cord blood, meaning that then that chemical crosses the placenta. In a separate analysis, we looked at the relationship between the chemicals themselves in the maternal blood to the adverse health outcomes, because they were pregnancy-related adverse health outcomes. So we found that the chemicals in our study that were detected in sufficient people to actually be able to look at this statistically, we found that the PFAS, the tridecanedioic acid, octadecanedioic acid, these are 2 fatty acids that are not normally found in people. They were previously only ever reported in individuals with RISE syndrome, so they are considered an abnormal fatty acid. And they're a chemical that's been reported by the industry to be used in plastics production. So we're finding that there's potentially an exogenous source of these chemicals, even though they're fatty acids. And we found that they were related with increased odds of gestational diabetes. So among the mother, we found an association between chemical exposure and gestational diabetes.
Exposure to PFOS.
Exposure to PFOS, as well as the fatty acids.
Huh. And so if I understood your study, the PFOSs seemed to be associated with gestational diabetes and the tridecanoic acid with hypertension.
Right. The tridecanedioic acid was also associated with hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. But we also found an association of the tridecanedioic and octadecanedioic acids with gestational diabetes.
Now, there's a demographic angle here. You write in your paper, race and ethnicity were included in models as an indicator of the exposure to structural racism, which is independently associated with chemical exposure and adverse pregnancy complications. Like women of color in the United States are more likely to experience poor pregnancy outcomes for themselves and their babies than Caucasian white women. The demographics of like gestational diabetes is more prevalent in women of color and Black women. Is this true?
That is true. It's also more prevalent in Latina women than in white women for gestational diabetes. We included race ethnicity in our model, which is something that is often done in epidemiology studies. When you're looking at the exposure, the relationship between an exposure and an outcome, you often include other variables that can impact the variability of the relationship that you want to see. And so we included race ethnicity in our model because we wanted to kind of limit that variability. But what we wanted to be clear is that race and ethnicity in and of itself doesn't cause disease or doesn't make you one exposed. So for example, I'm Mexican, and being Mexican doesn't in and of itself expose me to toxic chemicals. And when I moved to the U.S. for college, I moved to Richmond, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, just north of the San Francisco. And I saw in my community, which had a lot of Latino, Mexican, South and Central American, and African Americans in my community, there was higher rates of cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, and other adverse health outcomes. We also lived really close to one of the largest oil refineries in Northern California. And so I think that's an example of how communities of color are often overburdened by environmental exposures based on where they live, and are also exposed to two other stressors, sociodemographic stressors, that can exacerbate or modify the adverse health outcomes that they might be experiencing. So when we were adjusting for race and ethnicity in our model, we wanted to be really clear that by adjusting for race and ethnicity, we were trying to get at some of these broader sociodemographic factors that can influence exposure and health when we were evaluating the relationship between chemical exposure and gestational diabetes.
Does your evidence support the idea that, or the hypothesis that women of color, Black, Latino, Latinx are more susceptible to exposure to these toxic chemicals, and white women living perhaps in more affluent socioeconomic situations? I mean, are they more exposed to these chemicals, or do pre-existing susceptibility to these pregnancy-related conditions render them more susceptible to the chemicals? It's complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated. The evidence exists. The studies are out there that demonstrate the disproportionate exposure to toxic chemicals, as well as the disproportionate rates of different adverse health outcomes among communities of color. And for something like gestational diabetes, there have been changes, for example, in how we test for gestational diabetes, which has led to an increase in the rates of gestational diabetes. We know that communities like the Latino community has higher rates of gestational diabetes as well. But I think that those higher rates cannot be described solely by where they're from or these changes in diagnostics. And so the next question is how does chemical exposure impact these rates that we're seeing, because they can't be described. These increases in rates can't be described by demographic factors or by changes in diagnostics alone.
Rates of gestational diabetes and preeclampsia and hypertension and so on.
For example, yes.
So the bottom line is you examined the cord blood, the maternal blood serum and cord blood from how many women in total in your study?
We had 302 women in our study, and we examined the relationship between these chemical exposures, including these PFAS chemicals, these fatty acids that are used in plastics production, and gestational diabetes and pregnancy hypertensive disorders.
And they were present in the maternal blood serum and cord blood of people in your study?
Yes, all of our participants had multiple chemical exposures. They weren't all present in all participants or all cord blood samples. We detected these chemicals in almost all of our study participants.
And at what sorts of concentrations, like elevated concentrations or very low concentrations?
Some of these chemicals really haven't been tested in pregnant people before, so we don't really know what a normal or elevated concentration would be. And so that's one of the cool things about using a non-targeted analysis and identifying novel chemicals is that we are really able to identify new chemicals that are used in industry that we don't know what levels they're exposed to in people.
You mentioned earlier, Jessica Trowbridge, that infant mortality rates and health outcomes in pregnant women are lower in the United States than in most other developed countries. Can you run this by me again?
I didn't give any particular numbers. But we do know that maternal mortality and adverse health outcomes in women in the U.S. is among the worst in the developed world. And it's related to what I was saying earlier about gestational diabetes. We don't understand all of the causes of why the maternal mortality is so much worse in the U.S. compared to the rest of the developed world. We are highly exposed to multiple toxic chemicals. And so the question is there a link? And, you know, we need to understand more about the exposures to toxic chemicals. And we need to provide, you know, we need to be able to provide also this further evidence to encourage and to push the government and regulatory agencies to protect us from these toxic chemicals that are in our environment.
Next steps, where do you go from here?
So one of the goals of the program on reproductive health and the environment, the program I work for, is to one, conduct good science and advance the needle on what we know about exposure to toxic chemicals, particularly during pregnancy. And the other is to engage with policymakers and legislation, as well as regulatory agencies, to translate and communicate what we're finding so that they can take actionable steps to protect human health. So for us as a program, we are, you know, working on making sure that this information gets to the decision makers who can make changes. And it's also to continue to conduct studies in this area, to continue to describe and understand more about what we're exposed to broadly and what are the potential health impacts that those can have, those exposures can have.
Jessica Trowbridge, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Jessica Trowbridge is a research scientist in the program on reproductive health and the environment at the University of California, San Francisco. We'll link to her paper and program at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Shout out to CFMU and CKMS listeners in Hamilton and Waterloo, Ontario, and CKUW fans in Winnipeg. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Join us Friday, July 28th at 9 p.m. for a special performance by Jane Harms and Ian Davies to celebrate the release of Unit Pitt's limited edition Sound of the Sun Volume 1 cassette tape, available for purchase that evening. Jane Harms' new work, The Weekend of the Year, is featured on the compilation, which she will perform alongside several other works. Accompanying the celebration is the king of bedroom country, Ian Davies, who graciously brings his tunes for us from Montreal. Thank you to the Pale Fire for their support in hosting this event, which will additionally be an opportunity to see their current exhibit, Primes, showing works by Nicole Andre. Tickets are limited. Reserve your spot now. Pale Fire is located at 866 East Broadway, Vancouver.